It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. We meet a champion professional mountain bike racer now, a citizen of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, one of the six bands of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. She was the first woman to cross the finish line in the 527-mile Colorado Trail Race last month, setting a new record and doing it on, get this, a single speed bike. Join in on endurance cycling and representation in sport, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alexandra Houchin is an Anishinaabe woman, professional ultra cyclist. Alexandra, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So explain what sets ultra cycling apart first. How is ultra cycling different from other bike racing events?
Sure. So I guess ultra cycling is classified now as bike races that often take multiple days to finish. And I think every person who does these races classifies it differently. Like I'll do some 300 mile races and I kind of think those tend to be short, you know, it's on like one or two days of a bike ride. But I really like, you know, if I'm out there on the scale of more than 5 days, then you really get to kind of go through this whole transition of being like, oh, it's a bike race. Oh, I'm really tired. And then you get to go kind of push yourself past what you thought tired could be.
Mm. And bike packing, because there's a pack on your back at the same time.
It's bike packing because you are attaching all of these bags to your bicycle. And it's kind of like backpacking, right? You're going into the wilderness in places where you couldn't really go with panniers. You know, your panniers would pop off. But bike packing, the Colorado Trail Race, for example, is traditionally a hiking path that you are allowed to ride your bicycle on. So there's lots of walking and everything is strapped very tightly to my bicycle.
Mm. You are on these races that are hundreds of miles, sometimes thousands of miles in the Tour Divide. I'm so curious, what goes through your mind when you're out there so completely alone in the universe on these really grueling, fiercely rugged trails?
That's such a beautiful question, and I never get to answer it the same. I came into ultra racing kind of accidentally. I was looking for community because I was a bike tourist, notoriously. I'd ride my bike as a means of travel and seeing places at a cost-effective way. But over time, I started showing up to these ultra races, and I definitely never considered myself an athlete. Showing up for a race, I was like never thinking that I could win. That was never in the back of my mind. So day one, I'd mostly still, and I've been doing this for a long time. Day one, I start to question why I even thought I could show up. Like, I can't, I'm not as strong as these people because I tend to be at the back. And then as, you know, the days pass, day two, day three, I start to kind of forget comparing myself to people because the race field thins out. And then it's more about, okay, well, just, you know, keep going. You're getting used to the pattern of things. And by day three or four, it just becomes your life. And then as as you get closer to the finish line, I tend to push sleep and go to super spiritual places. Mm. And I feel really lucky that I have my cultural teachings and cultural lessons, because I never really feel alone out there. Despite being alone, I never feel lonely. I have I have so many different communities traveling with me in my heart. And there's also racers out there. You know, you think you're all alone, and then the only person enduring this terrible weather. And then you get to a gas station and somebody else is sitting there. You're like, oh, yeah.
A human, a person. I'm going to reintroduce you for a moment, talking with professional ultra cyclist Alexandra Houchin. Grew up in Rock County. You can join in. What do you want to ask her? 800-642-1234. Another dimension that defines you, and you touched on it so lightly here, but it is your native heritage. And, you know, as a citizen of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, how does that inform your ultra cycling, or how does your ultra cycling inform your native heritage?
A lot of ultra cycling, I started pursuing it to kind of figure out what my limits were and who I was and the greater things about life, really trying to go deep within myself. And I didn't really connect my native identity with cycling for quite a long time. I kind of thought that I either had to be a cyclist, a bike racer, a bike shop mechanic, et cetera, or I could be a native person working in my my community, doing things to uplift Indian country. But over time, I started realizing that I need to hone in on both of those parts of myself to be the best version of myself. And as much as bike racing started out about bike racing or meeting community and then turning into, you know, wanting to compete, it really started to turn into this ceremony for me as a contemporary Native person who grew up super disconnected from my tribal community and my ancestral roots. I had super colonized perceptions of Indigenous people ingrained into my head. And it's only been within the past handful of years where I realized that, you know, not all of our traditional stuff has always been traditional. We're constantly evolving and growing people. So maybe, you know, 50 years ago, riding in long bike races wasn't ceremony, but as a contemporary Native woman, it is ceremony to me. And it's a place where I am able to really go deep within myself and my spirit and kind of figure out how I can be the best relative. And I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know that was a thing. It's not really that easy to carve out 5 or 6 days in regular life, you know, to like think for 24 hours a day. But you can do that in bike racing.
A lot of time to think. And I think about how just imagining you out there racing on sacred lands, on now public lands, and I wonder how you see land differently as an Indigenous woman, and especially out on these trails, on these public lands. What does that say about sovereignty and the lands that you ride on?
Oh, geez, there's lots of conversation to be had about this concept of public land. And that's a whole, like, I could tell you 25 hours about that. But really, little acts of showing up, I think, remind my ancestors that we're still here. So even though I'm not on lands that are ancestral to me, I am still outside and I am doing these things, these bike races, in the best way that I can. And I do my best to make offerings and to essentially leave little messages, letting all the Manidu, it's our word for spirits, I guess, letting the Manidu know that we're still here and we're still doing the things that make us Anishinaabe.
Alexandra Houchin holds the women's record on a single-speed bike in the Tour Divide, calls the ultra-endurance cycling community her family. Join in on these races. Join in on Native lands, extreme weather challenges, and mountain biking. We're going to get to that next. Your questions about navigating trail rides, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We go inside the world of an ultra cyclist. And in recent years, Alexandra Houchin has come into her own, a dominant competitor in extreme distance races on a single speed bike, mountain bike, wants to inspire more people from indigenous communities to follow in her tracks. Join in on professional mountain bike racing, diversifying sport. 800-642-1234. And Alexandra stays with us. Okay, are you ready for some fun questions here? We've got, Nate from Stevens Point called, couldn't stay with us. Nate and Nate's daughter wonder what you eat while riding out there and whether you have any favorite foods on these really long distance rides.
Oh, geez, I've made some catastrophic food choices on this journey. It's really hard because mostly you resupply at gas stations and you have to eat high calorie food that keeps you going, but you also need food that tastes good to you because at some point it's kind of like your job to eat, actually. You know, I'm trying to eat every single hour.
And hydrate, I imagine you got to get so much water in you.
Yeah. You know, the water part is much easier. There tends to be lots of water in the mountains and around, and I can filter from lakes and streams, and water is generally less of a worry. But food, you know, I used to love Snickers. I still eat Snickers. They're great, high calorie, kind of just like shove 200, 300 calories into your mouth quick. Milky Way Midnights are also a favorite. You can't have any of those candy bars though when it's hot, otherwise they just melt and you're like licking a wrapper and trying to ride your bike at the same time.
Not good.
Doritos, Cool Ranch Doritos are also a favorite. It's those really big bags of chips have lots of calories in them at a really light weight. Like a big family size bag of Doritos has about 3,000 calories.
So Nate has his hands over his daughter's ears at this point.
It's mostly horrible junk food. You know, one time I brought those Amy's burritos. I'm like, oh, they're so healthy. It has broccoli. And by like day two, they just broke apart and I'm trying to pour the burrito out of the wrapper. So really kind of processed food, like Tina's burritos are also a favorite. The little orange 90-cent burritos from the grocery store.
So what creature comfort do you take in your pack that you need, but you could do without on, you know, a bike packing competitive ride?
A lot, pretty much I have my pack dialed as light as I can, as minimal as I can. Because you don't really want too much comfort. Otherwise, you could find yourself sleeping for too long.
Oh.
I just try to keep enough to keep me alive. I guess.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess I bring a little JBL boombox that I strap to my backpack so I can listen to music on the road. Sometimes I get scared of cars and I like to be able to hear the things around me. So I like that. It helps me stay awake at night sometimes too.
I saw a picture of the bottom of your feet out on the Tour Divide. They look like they really hurt. How do you make sure your body doesn't deteriorate?
It really does, but no matter what you do. But I try to do a lot of self-care. Like I usually take at least one shoe off break a day where I take my shoes off, let my feet air out. I try to bring I bring a lot more socks than a lot more of my competitors, I've recently learned. Just because I really, you know, having all your contact points that are touching your bike and touching the ground safe and sanitary is kind of an important thing. You know, you can't really go forward if your feet don't work or if you have really bad saddle sores.
Cindy from Menominee Falls called in and has some questions for you. Doesn't know anything about ultra cycling, super curious how it works, and is just curious about the races themselves. Where do you camp along the way? Where do you sleep? And how long the races last?
Sure. So Ultra endurance races used to be a little bit more underground than they are now. I think the internet and social media has really made it a lot more accessible to a lot more people. But the races are kind of all over. There's races worldwide now, and they tend to be ultra endurance. I think it has to be, I would say it has to be like at least 30 plus hours if you're like staying awake the entire time.
Oh my goodness.
And that, you know, the mileage changes. If it's a road ultra, you know, it's a lot easier to go 300 miles than on a trail ultra. And some of them are on gravel roads, some of them are on paved roads, and some of them are on trails. And as far as sleep, it everybody kind of looks at sleep differently. For those at the pointy end of the race, meaning the front, you know, the first top 10 or so, they're not really sleeping that much. And you kind of just like pedal until 2 or 3 in the morning or a dark time, and you just lay out your sleep kit on the side of the trail, on the side of the road. Grab an hour of sleep, grab 20 minutes of sleep, grab 2 hours of sleep, but it's not really, sleep is not really that much of a concern in the ultra races because the winning people are just not really doing it much.
Oh my goodness. Alexandra Houchin with us, professional ultra cyclist, grew up in Wisconsin. You can join in on this. Maybe you are part of the ultra cycling community. 800-642-1234. Alexandra, what about your bike ever breaking down, or why a single speed bike? Why do you choose that?
I love single speed bicycles, and I think it's for there's lots of reasons. I always give different answers to this one too. For sure, it's, you know, ease of equipment. There's so many fewer parts. I don't have to worry about a derailleur. I don't have to worry about a shifter, and I don't have to worry about babying it through hard terrain. And sometimes I just get sleepy and I accidentally drop my bike, or it's really brushy and I'm dragging my bike through trees, or it's really muddy and wet, and my chain and the rest of my drivetrain are just caked in mud, and I don't really have to worry about any mechanical issues from my drivetrain not being tuned in quite right. So definitely simpler, definitely cheaper, you know, it's less stuff. And
Simplify to just what you need out there.
yeah.
What ultra cycling events will you take on next? Where are you headed?
The next race that is on my calendar is it's called the Arizona Trail Race, and it's a race across the state of Arizona on the National Scenic Hiking Trail. It starts in kind of at the Mexico border, just outside of Sierra Vista, Arizona. And then it's kind of like in the center of the state, actually. And you head north up to the Utah border. It's about 800 miles. And you have to disassemble your bicycle at the Grand Canyon and strap it to your back and then hike down and across and up out of the Grand Canyon.
Wow. So how do you prepare for something like that?
So I finished it last year. I wasn't going very fast though, because I was injured, but I did finish the Arizona Trail Race last year. So I'm familiar with the course. Ideally, I'd be in Arizona right now, riding my bike and getting used to the heat and to the elevation, but my schedule doesn't allow for that. So hopefully I can get out there and do a little bit more riding and training before the race starts. But I kind of just, you know, keep showing up to races sporadically through the year, and then kind of, I just ride my bike like normal, like an average person, and maybe do some strength and weight training here and there. And I farm, so I keep active, but I don't really do any crazy coaching or dedicated training plan for these races.
Oh, so fascinating. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us, and all the best to you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciated all the good questions.
Oh, appreciate you. Alexandra Houchin is an Anishinaabe woman, a citizen of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa in Minnesota, a record-holding professional cyclist. Up ahead, we talk to Milwaukee County Supervisor about health equity and government spending priorities. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we check in on pressing issues before the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors, made up of 18 representatives, 9 standing committees, tackling issues like budget and taxation, transportation, health equity. And its Committee of the Whole meets later this month, addressing big policy issues before the full board. Join in 800-642-1234. Marcilia Nicholson is chairwoman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors, was reelected in April, and is serving for a fourth term. Marcilia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, as we're in the midst of budget season ramping up, what are your top priorities for the next couple of years in office? What are you focused on?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that question. It's such a great question. And I have made achieving racial equity my number one priority. So in 2019, I sponsored a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis in Milwaukee County. That made us the first local government in the nation to do so. And I'm proud to share that since then, more than 200 other counties and cities across the nation have taken that lead. Our vision here in Milwaukee is to become the healthiest county in the state by achieving racial equity, because we know that a rising tide lifts all boats. Right now, Milwaukee ranks 71 out of 72 counties in health outcomes. And right now in Milwaukee, the zip code you're born in and the color of your skin determines whether you have the tools necessary to thrive either locally in our global economy. And recently, this work took me all across the state, all corners of it, to lead these regional diversity, equity, and inclusion meetings. We did this with county officials from just about every county in Wisconsin, and I learned so much about the issues facing other counties, like the unique forms of diversity they hold. For example, inequities around age, gender, and accessibility were bigger factors and challenges for our rural states, and hopefully they learned from me as well, you know, a younger woman of color. From the largest county in the state, we are often divided in some of our messaging, and we really want to make sure that there's always a sense of belonging for everyone in the state of Wisconsin. And in addition to that, I've also made securing Milwaukee County's fiscal future a top priority. We know that without a long-term solution, by 2027, we'll have no local dollars to fund our parks, our bus routes, our arts, and culture that people care about, our senior services or youth services that our constituents depend on. We've been working to close a gap of over $340 million over the last decade. And prior to the CARES and ARPA funding we've been receiving, we were contending with annual gaps of around $20 to $30 million. And we have limited tools at our disposal to raise or secure that revenue to fill those gaps. And that leads to service cuts. These are quality of life amenities are, you know, constituents depend on. That makes Milwaukee great. And if we lose that status as being an attractive region to live, to work, and to play, it really could have a devastating impact on our economy and in our region. And that can impact the entire state of Wisconsin. So, again, I'm so happy to be able to have this discussion with you and for your listeners so we can raise awareness around all of this.
And we're going to get to budget gaps in a moment and how you're working through that as a board. But I just want to ask you on the issue of health equity, you know, as National Hispanic Heritage Month kicks off today, in fact, what do you bring from your background and heritage into your county board leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. So just a little bit about me. I grew up in the poor zip code in the state, the 53206 zip code. And, you know, my personal story and narrative that I shared on the road was, you know, I was born of a Puerto Rican mother and a man from Alabama. And they worked very, very hard. And because of the neighborhood I was born in, I had less accessibility to, you know, opportunities that will allow me to thrive. And so having resources at our disposal that allowed me to, you know, level the playing field and get ahead in life really is, you know, an exception and not the rule. You know, the fact that I heard gunshots at night and saw things that no child will see and 3 miles away in an affluent suburb, you know, my white peer is, you know, growing up in a large house in a fully funded public system and have, you know, beautiful green parks to live in. It means that, you know, we have a lot of work to do and that my unique perspective and experiences mean that I understand where people are and, you know, opportunities that folks need to get ahead as well.
Let's spend some time here on crime and violence. The Milwaukee Police Department data shows homicides on pace to break a record this year. The police chief, Jeffrey Norman, over the summer publicly voiced frustration that people in the community were using firearms to resolve simple conflicts. His words there. How should local policymakers address the gun violence in Milwaukee?
You know, gun violence is just like, you know, many other challenges throughout Milwaukee and our state, outcomes of, you know, bad policies throughout the years, and also challenges that community face through to, you know, oppression and lack of investment since the beginning of our time. We're now seeing the outcome of trauma. We're seeing the outcome of poverty. We're seeing the outcome of hunger and of hopelessness. And I really believe that as policymakers, we have a unique responsibility to, you know, intentionally craft policy that will not only, right, like, get at the issue at hand today, reduce that gun violence through various efforts, but to also get at the root of our problem, you know, to raise wages, to create family-sustaining jobs, to fund our education system, to invest in our neighborhoods and our communities so that people have, you know, quality amenities that they can access. Expanding broadband internet and so on and so on so that folks have the basic necessities, the basic tools that they need, and they don't have to revert to such extreme actions because of what they face in life and because of how they feel inside because of that.
I want to pause right here talking about the latest issues facing Milwaukee. We have the chairwoman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors, Marcelia Nicholson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Issues you see facing Milwaukee County, issues you want the Board of Supervisors to prioritize and why, and how you see budget funding through your neighborhood and community. I want to turn to fall referendums. This summer, the board approved two advisory ballot measures for the November election. One, as we are talking about violence, is to ban assault rifles and semi-automatic weapons. Why did the board approve this referendum?
Well, one of the main reasons why the referendum was put on the table is because of the countless mass shootings that we are experiencing as a country and as a nation, which are completely unacceptable because everyone deserves the opportunity to live on earth, you know, and not have their lives taken away from them. And, you know, this reverberates across the country for us. And, you know, it really is a issue that we need to tackle now and today. We can't afford to wait on this issue. And so having the opportunity to have this question on the ballot and to, you know, pose this question to our constituents, where do you stand on this issue, Hopefully policy outcomes will come from that question, and we can start to, you know, tackle this issue not only in Milwaukee, but at the state legislature, where change absolutely has to be made.
Another measure is asking voters about statewide legalization of recreational marijuana. Do you support the legalization of marijuana statewide?
Well, you know, we held this we had this question on a ballot recently, and I supported it then. I believe this will provide us additional revenue that will, you know, allow the state to become competitive nationally and globally. We'll be able to invest in key areas that we've seen disinvestment in. And additionally, decriminalizing marijuana is important for communities, especially throughout Milwaukee, where we've seen mass incarceration hit communities of color, where we see Black men jailed at disproportionate rates due to either use of marijuana or, holding with or intent to sell, whereas in other cities and counties across the country, this is a business for people, and it's a business that's heavily predominantly held by, you know, our white peers. And so I do think this is an important issue. It's a racial equity issue. It's a good get at the root of our problems issue. And it's an opportunity to raise, again, much needed revenue that we can invest in public safety, that we can invest in education, that we can invest in our communities and so on.
Revenue seems to be a thread of this conversation, and thinking about how the state has its, you know, largest rainy day fund in history, billions of dollars. Milwaukee County has been very vocal in the past about shared revenue. Can you explain your thoughts there on where you see shared revenue going and what it means for Milwaukee County?
Yeah, I mean, you know, shared revenue is important because that's our return on our investment that we, you know, send billions of dollars to the state of Wisconsin. And we need this money back in return to invest in our state mandated, services. We continue to be impacted by ongoing structural deficits caused by, you know, revenue caps and the increased cost of state mandated services. I mean, the supply chain situation and inflation also impacts the services that people rely on every day. We also saw an increase in youth census. You know, we have, again, historically high inflation, and we have an operating budget gap of $12.6 million estimated for 23, and our capital projects requests are exceeded our funding by $84 million. And so, you know, it's essential that we have, again, the resources necessary to fund not only those state-mandated services, because that's key. If we're giving a mandate to provide a service, at the very minimum, we should get the funding, the complete funding to, you know, provide that service. Mm-hmm. But also, it allows us the opportunity to be creative and innovative in how we move forward. If we're constantly contending with budget gaps, if we're constantly trying to fill a hole, we have no opportunity to build anything above ground. To, you know, reinvest in key areas that we know will make Milwaukee an even greater city to live in. And so getting that shared revenue, figuring out a new structure, or the 1% sales tax that we're, you know, working to accomplish will also be a tool that we can use to fill those gaps so that we can give our residents what they deserve.
Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors Chair Marcelia Nicholson, first elected in 2016, giving us insight into the issues the board takes up, fielding your questions about the work of a county board, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors will get a presentation of the 2023 recommended budget by the county executive at the end of the month. Board will hold its annual public hearing on the recommended budget on Tuesday, November 1st. Join in on County Board's budget priorities in these times, 800-642-1234. We have Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors Chair Marcellia Nicholson, who stays with us. You know, you say Milwaukee County is managing a revenue crisis that has forced board members to cut about $30 million from the budget each year. Which public services are most at risk?
You know, any service that our community rely on is equally important. But we've seen cuts across the board. We've seen cuts to our youth services, to our aging and disability services, to our transit system, for instance, to our cultural institutions. I mean, if you're keeping up with news in Milwaukee, you'll know that our domes, you know, is in dire need of funding. You know, it really touches every level of service. I mean, our parks are in deferred maintenance and to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. We really need this local sales tax option so that we can raise much needed revenue so that we don't have to depend on raising property taxes, charging higher fees to meet the needs of our constituents.
Let's bring on a call now. Nancy is joining us from Milwaukee County. Nancy, hi. What's on your mind?
Hello. I live in the city of Milwaukee, zip code 53216. And I'm very angry because 2 years ago it was reported in an article in the Milwaukee Journal that the Milwaukee County Museum was spending $1,000 a week to keep open the butterfly room. This at a time when, because of the pandemic, the museum was not even open. I've called many supervisors about that. Supreme Moore was the supervisor in charge of finances at that time. He never even bothered returning a phone call. And now he's in the assembly in Madison. But I do think it's more than think. I mean, it is absolutely imperative that Milwaukee County start looking. If you're still funding at $1,000 a week, keeping open the butterfly room at the public museum, I am going to be very angry.
Nancy, thank you for that call. Marcellia, what can you say there?
Nancy, so great to hear from you. Please feel free to reach out to my office at any time. I also encourage you to tune in on Thursday, September 29th, for the county executive budget presentation to the full board. That's at 9:30 a.m., and you can find that link on our county Legislative Information Center. If you just Google County Legislative Information Center, it'll take you right to our calendar. And then finally, I'll just add that, you know, the public museum is, you know, it's a jewel, it's a gem in our county. It is privately funded as well as publicly funded. So I do want to let you know that while that is a shocking number, you know, Milwaukee County is not responsible for that entire amount. We're also, you know, investing at the front end in a new museum so that we don't have to spend much money on our amenities that are lacking in our museum right now. That's why so many of the costs are high. And again, I just encourage you to reach out to my office and to attend or watch the county executive's hearing, his presentation. And then we'll also have our annual hearing on November 1, where you can come and tell us supervisors in person or virtually what issues you care about, what your priorities are, and how you think we should handle our business. And we fully welcome that and anyone else listening right now as well.
I want to turn to government personnel and workforce. You know, in the Great Resignation, unemployment also being so low, workers have more options. Is the Milwaukee County grappling with people leaving their government jobs?
You know, just like, you know, any other sector, Milwaukee County is, you know, we are seeing vacancies and we are seeing turnover. I will add, though, that Milwaukee County is an amazing place to work, and we're doing some amazing things to make sure that we can recruit and retain our amazing employees and those amazing employees to come. We've just allocated a 2% raise to all employees. We want to make sure that we can contend with inflation. I personally, at the Board of Supervisors, am paying interns for the first time, creating pathways, hiring a more diverse staff, providing more opportunities, breaking barriers for more people to have entry into Milwaukee County government and working in Milwaukee County government. And the county executive is doing such as well. All across the board. So yes, you know, we're seeing, you know, turnover and vacancy just like any other sector. You know, the pandemic was very challenging and the field is competitive. And, you know, like, let's be honest, people are, you know, very tired and some folks are leaving the workforce, not because they don't like their jobs, but because they're physically unable at some, you know, in some areas to do so. But again, we at Milwaukee County are dedicated to our workforce. We're working hard to recruit and retain and also celebrate the unique diversity that our staff holds as well.
Talking with Marcelia Nicholson, chair of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Turning to lead pipes, Milwaukee Public Works says about 40% of water service lines in the city are made of lead. And as we've seen, federal officials, infrastructure law, putting in millions of dollars for lead pipe replacement. Where do lead pipes stand now in Milwaukee?
Well, lead pipes in Milwaukee are still in need for investment. I'm very thankful for funding allocated by Governor Evers to support our infrastructure. I'm very thankful for our allies in Congress and the U.S. Senate and the president for wanting to invest in this area, knowing that it's so important that, you know, every child, every man and woman has access to clean drinking water. So this still continues to be an issue that our community is concerned about. You know, Milwaukee's infrastructure is large, which means we need a lot of funding to tackle this issue. But again, our elected officials are, I think, committed across the board, regardless of background, regardless of, you know, political affiliation or standing. We know that everyone, again, deserves clean access to clean water. And so I'm thankful, again, for the investment that's already happening. And then just sharing that we really need our state partners to be, you know, willing to work on this issue as well, so that we can have, you know, long-term you know, approaches to how we tackle challenges.
We only have a few seconds left, but when County Executive David Crawley presents the 2023 recommended budget, what will be the overriding question on your mind with that presentation?
Just like any other budget address, I want to make sure that we are investing and reinvesting in our services that the community cares about most. Our parks, our transit system, our youth and family services, will there be investment in that area? That's my key question. And as we have the ability to amend the budget, we'll add on, strengthen it, tighten it as our community sees fit.
Marcelia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Marcelia Nicholson is chair of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. Just ahead, we explore how school districts navigate gender identity after a group of Eau Claire parents sue the school district over its guidelines. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.